Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. As always, at this time of week, we'll be joining Jill Bevilacqua for her very personal reflection on the Sunday Gospel by the intriguing title of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. As you'll discover in a moment, it begins with Sean Patrick Ravitt reading the Gospel.
The angel Gabriel was sent from God to a town of Galilee named Nazareth, to a virgin betrothed to a man named Joseph of the house of David. The virgin's name was Mary. Upon arriving, the angel said to her, "Rejoice, O highly favored daughter, the Lord is with you. Blessed are you among women." She was deeply troubled by his words and wondered what his greeting meant. The angel went on to say to her, "Do not fear, Mary. You have found favor with God. You shall conceive and bear a son, and give him the name Jesus. Great will be his dignity, and he will be called Son of the Most High. The Lord God will give him the throne of David his father. He will rule over the house of Jacob forever, and his reign will be without end." Mary said to the angel, "How can this be, since I do not know man?" The angel answered her, "The Holy Spirit will come upon you, and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. Hence the holy offspring will be born and will be called Son of God. Know that Elizabeth, your kinswoman, has conceived a son in her old age. She who was thought to be sterile is now in her sixth month, for nothing is impossible with God." Mary said, "I am the maidservant of the Lord. Let it be done to me as you say." With that, the angel left her.
It's hard to think of another gospel episode which has been more frequently or more lovingly represented by poets and painters than the Annunciation. But then we're talking of the Annunciation, of the most important event the world has ever known, hardly to be called merely an episode either. The word seems to diminish the event. This unique happening, and the modern word is by far more apt, was not an isolated incident. It happened in our dimension, in time. And it had been foretold by Isaiah, "Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and his name shall be called Emmanuel." The Annunciation, then, is part of a story, the story of salvation. But it's so momentous that it is also a story in itself. And of the four evangelists, it's Luke, that master among storytellers, who tells it. Like all good stories, it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's neither too long nor too short. Every word has been weighed carefully. There is not one too many. And how else could it be? For there were no witnesses of the Annunciation. Luke, then, could not have written his account, which, though a story, is not fiction, unless he had heard it from the chief protagonist, Mary herself. And she would not have been one for small talk. She would have wasted no words. The event which shaped her life must have been carved in her memory down to the tiniest detail. But she, in Luke's words, gives only the essentials. It's been left to the centuries to fill in the rest. Here's how one poet, the German Rainer Maria Rilke, imagines the encounter of Gabriel and Mary in two separate poems. Here he has given the angel these words.
"You are not nearer God than we. He's far from everyone. And yet your hands most wonderfully reveal his benison. From woman's sleeves none ever grew so ripe, so shimmeringly. I am the day, I am the dew. You, lady, are the tree. Pardon, now my long journey is done. I had forgot to say what he who sat as in the sun, grand in his gold array, told me to tell you, pensive one. Space has bewildered me. I am the start of what's begun. You, lady, are the tree. I spread my wings out wide and rose. The space around grew less. Your little house quite overflows with my abundant dress. But still you keep your solitude and hardly notice me. I'm but a breeze within the wood. You, lady, are the tree.
Scholars and theologians may balk at the opening lines and at the idea that Gabriel might be so bewildered as to forget his message, but they must allow some poetic license. In the second poem, the writer begins by giving us Mary's point of view, and then, well, let's listen.
The angel's entrance, you must realize, was not what made her frightened. The surprise he gave her by his coming was no more than sun or moonbeam shining on the floor would give another. She had long since grown used to the form that angels wear, descending, never imagining this coming down was hard for them. Oh, it's past comprehending how pure she was. Did not one day a hind that rested in a wood, watchfully staring, feel her deep influence? And did it not conceive the unicorn then without pairing, the pure beast which light begot? No, not to see him enter, but to find the youthful angel's countenance inclined so near to her that when he looked and she looked up at him, their look so merged in one, the world outside grew vacant suddenly, and all things being seen, endured and done were crowded into them, just she and he, I and its pasture, vision and its view, here, at this point, and at this point alone. See, this arouses fear. Such fear both knew. Then he sang out and made his tidings known.
Let's look a moment now at the place where this historic meeting is believed to have happened. Here's what we read in the guidebook.
On the northern outskirts of downtown Nazareth is a fountain, still used by the inhabitants of the town. Tradition tells that by the fountain, the angel Gabriel first appeared to Mary while she was drawing water. From here, Mary went to her home, where the Annunciation took place.
It all sounds so matter-of-fact, doesn't it? But it was the apocryphal Gospels that started the tradition of this belief. And when the Crusaders came, they built a church to Gabriel on the spot. The guidebook goes on. Over it stands the present-day Greek Orthodox Church, built in 1769. Remnants of the Crusader Church can be seen in the crypt. The water of the Fountain of Mary, inside the crypt, is in fact conveyed into the church from a nearby spring further uphill. From here, the water is piped to a fountain. Another guidebook has a colour photograph of the crypt with the fountain and confirms that it is the only one existing in the old town of Nazareth. Traveller H.V. Morton wrote in the 30s.
One is shown all kinds of holy places in Nazareth, but perhaps the only one that rarely convinces is the Virgin's Fountain. This is, and ever has been, the only water supply of Nazareth. The stream gushes out of the mountain and runs through a conduit to a public fountain where women fill petrol tins with water all day long. The Greeks have built a church above the source of this spring, and when you go down into the darkness of the sanctuary, you can hear the water bubbling up from the rock. This must be the spring from which the Virgin Mary drew water.
Significantly, our traveller does not touch on the subject of where Gabriel came to Mary. But the traveller of today will not be able to miss the Basilica of the Annunciation. Our guidebook proclaims, The church, located in the centre of Nazareth, is a modern structure built between 1955 and 1969 over the ruins of Byzantine and Crusader churches. It is easily recognised by its high dome, which makes it the most prominent structure in the city. Gabriel wouldn't have been able to miss it either, no doubt. But, according to legend, Mary's house is no longer in Nazareth, for in the year 1291 it was carried by angels to Dalmatia, and 3 years later to Loreto on the Adriatic coast. And on April the 12th, 1916, the Congregation of Rites issued a decree stating that this house was the home of the Blessed Virgin, consecrated by the Divine Mysteries. Today it's one of the most celebrated of Marian shrines. The house itself, though enclosed in a church, is tiny, 12 metres by 6, and on the altar is a black figure of the Virgin and Child in cedar, said to be the first work of St. Luke. When I visited Loreto years ago, the place was thronged. We were hustled round the altar and out of the church at top speed. This is my abiding memory of Mary's house. But let's return to the Gospel and its content. The first word Gabriel spoke to Mary has usually been rendered as Hail, which is the first word of the Hail Mary, also known as the Angelic Salutation. And in a homily attributed to Gregory of Nyssa, 4th century Doctor of the Church, the translation I have read is like this.
The angel comes to Mary, and entering says, Hail, full of grace. In an instant he exalts the maiden and treats her as a woman, for she has become the mother of the Lord.
But further on we find these words.
For calamity is at an end, corruption is dissolved, all sadness now has ceased, joy has flourished, the glad tidings of the prophets have come to pass.
And here seems to be the point, joy. The angel's greeting to Mary was expressed in a word normally used in Greek at the time, later translated to the Latin Ave. Luke, of course, was writing in Greek. But the Greek word meant joy, or as today's Gospel version has it, rejoice. And this seems to be the theme in these lines from the Sibylline Oracles, no connection with Virgil's Sibyl, but 14 books of didactic poetry in Greek hexameters, dating from the 2nd century.
Thus spoke the archangel to the maiden. Receive, O Virgin, the Lord in your immaculate womb. At these words the Lord gave grace to her, who was to be forever virgin. She, hearing these words, was filled with wonder and with dread. In stillness she stood trembling, bewildered, as one lost, the while her heart did throb to hear the wondrous news. Then jumped her heart with joy to find comfort in those words. She smiled, with blushing cheek, delighting in her joy, heart filled with gentle modesty. And courage came again, and soared the word within her womb.
Immediately after his first word, Gabriel says, O highly favoured daughter. The Jerusalem Bible reads, Rejoice, so highly favoured, while the Revised Standard Version and another older translation have Hail, full of grace. Scholars have interpreted the Greek word charis differently. Since St. Paul, we read, the word has meant sanctifying grace, but it might, according to one, have meant privilege. A present-day scholar writes, full of grace, literally filled with grace, by God himself, so as to be the mother of his son. St. Augustine puts it charmingly.
Who are you that with such faith have conceived, and soon is to become a mother? The one who created you will be born in you. Whence came to you such great goodness? You are virgin, you are holy. Much it is you have merited, or better, much it is you have received. It seems an indiscretion that I question thus the Virgin, and so disturb her reserve. But the Virgin, blushing yet, to me replies, You ask whence came to me such goodness? Listen to the angel's greeting, and believe in the salvation which comes from my womb. Believe in him in whom I have believed.
In the innumerable paintings of the scene of the Annunciation, there's almost always a lily, shown either between Mary and the angel or in Gabriel's hand. But in a poem for Lady Day, March the 25th, an English writer exclaims, "Where did Gabriel get a lily in the month of March?" For in England, the Madonna lily blooms in summer. And gardener Vita Sackville-West adds, "Wherever that bright archangel found his lily, it was certainly not in the more ambitious sort of garden. It prefers the humbler home. There's an old tradition that the Madonna lily throve best in cottage gardens because the housewife was in the habit of chucking out her pail of soap suds all over the flower beds." The ceiling of the Church of the Annunciation, we read, has been fashioned in the shape of a lily. Whether Gabriel actually appeared visibly to Mary, Luke doesn't say, only he came to her, or being come in, he went in, and upon arriving. In the book of Daniel, he's described like this: "His body was clear as topaz, his face shone like lightning, his eyes were like burning lamps, his arms and legs had the gleam of bronze, and when he spoke, it was like the voice of a multitude." Writing in 1912, Rupert Brooke ended his poem, Mary and Gabriel, this way:
"The great wings were spread, showering glory on the fields and fire. The whole air singing bore him up and higher, unswerving, unreluctant. Soon he shone a gold speck in the gold skies, then was gone. The air was colder and grey. She stood alone."
Modern poet Elizabeth Jennings has imagined the aftermath of the Annunciation.
"Nothing will ease the pain to come, though now she sits in ecstasy and lets it have its way with her. The angel's shadow in the room is lightly lifted, as if he had never terrified her there. The furniture again returns to its old, simple state. She can take comfort from the things she knows, though in her heart new loving burns, something she never gave to man or God before. And this God grows most like a man. She wonders how to pray at all, what thanks to give, and whom to give them to. Alone to all men's eyes I now must go, she thinks, and by myself must live with a strange child that is my own." So from her ecstasy she moves and turns to human things at last, announcing angels set aside. It is a human child she loves, though a God stirs beneath her breast and great salvations grip her side.
Of Mary, many have been the titles and poetic descriptions. Some less well-known ones appear in this hymn by an early 5th century writer, Ezekias of Jerusalem.
"Who calls her Mother of Light, Star of Life? Some call her Throne of God, others Great Temple of Heaven. One, a seat not inferior to that of the Cherubim, yet another, Virgin and Fertile Garden, Vine of fine grapes, flourished and untouched, pure turtle dove, chaste dove, uncorrupted cloud filled with rain, jewel case, whose gem shines more brightly than the sun, quarry from which has been hewn without cutting the stone which shelters all the earth, vessel without steersman, charge of precious things, treasure which grows rich. Yet others call her lamp without a wick, which burns by itself, ark more spacious, longer, more noble than that of Noah."
St. Paulinus of Nola adds yet another image, but provides us also with the only possible ending to these reflections on the Annunciation.
"God created the holy maidservant like the interior courtyard of a temple, respectfully surrounded by reverence, open to the rain and the dew. Then he himself descended from the clouds of heaven on silent wing, soft and humble, as once the dew fell upon Gideon's fleece. But no one has succeeded in penetrating the mystery, fulfilled in the silent way of God, become man in the womb of a virgin.
And now, while we say goodbye to Gilbert Villacqua, thanking her for yet another programme, we welcome Joan Lewis.
A very happy Christmas from myself and all my colleagues.
Well, to you and all my colleagues. And to all of our listeners, wherever they are listening to us, may it be a blessed, beautiful Christmas and a very joyful and fulfilling and very special New Year.
Everything's in place in the Vatican, isn't it? The Christmas tree's up.
The Christmas tree's up. The nativity scene will be unveiled, as is traditional, on Christmas Eve. And it looks like it's going to be gigantic. I mean, it was huge last year. But the amount of St. Peter's Square that is closed, that canvas covered, so you can't see what the workers are working on, it seems to occupy a lot more space this year. So, but the tree was lit on last weekend, and it is the tallest tree ever to grace St. Peter's Square. It's 109 feet, 33 meters, I believe that is, and it was donated by the region of Lower Austria. And I want to tell you, I have for years put pictures on my blog of this ceremony. And so I went over there Saturday. You know, we awoke for the first time in like a week to sunshine and blue skies. Of course, that lasted till like 1 in the afternoon. And then by 4:30, it was absolutely pouring rain. But the 850 pilgrims from Austria and all the, you know, bishops and everything else, they were protected, the bishops, but not the pilgrims or the singers. Anyway, it was a lovely ceremony, and the tree looks very beautiful. And the lovely thing is, for all the work that goes into putting up the nativity scene, because they begin the first week in November, it stays up until the Feast of the Presentation, the 2nd of February. So visitors to Rome who come at Christmas, who come in January, will get to see this. So the Vatican is indeed getting ready, and the Pope obviously referred to Christmas a couple times.
So last weekend was kind of quite a key moment, because we had the Christmas tree
and then
with its twinkling lights.
Yes.
And then on 1500
Sunday. 1,500 lights, by the way.
1,500.
If you're counting. 1,500 lights, 2,000 ornaments. And there's a wonderful star at the top. I thought my eyes were playing tricks on me, but it gets stronger and then weaker. The light gets stronger and then weaker. Anyway, that's the star.
It's I went by on Sunday morning, there was a little bit of sunshine there on Sunday morning, and and the children were holding up
the statues of baby Jesus. This is traditional, although I have to do some homework, as I've tried to find out the exact origin, what pope, what day, what year did this tradition start of children bringing their little bambinelli, the little statues of baby Jesus, to the square to be blessed by the pope. And these they will put in their homes and schools and various places, obviously,
on Christmas Eve.
So that's a very nice custom, but I have yet to discover the exact origins of that. And both at the Angelus on Sunday and again at the audience on Wednesday, the Pope focused exclusively on Christmas. And the audience was really quite wonderful. He said, you know, this, we're not just celebrating the birth of some great, big, important figure. This is a life-changing event, certainly for us Christians. It is, as St. John wrote, it's the Word made flesh. It's life-changing. It was history-changing. And the Pope talks about Christmas being the finest gift that we can possibly be given, the Christ, the child Jesus. And you know, the Pope also talked about it actually several times this week. Another aspect, he pointing to the economic crisis in the world, which has affected just so many people all over the globe, he said this could be a time to actually go back to very Christmas and very Christian values of simplicity, of friendship, of solidarity, instead of this hedonistic, materialistic, time when we think only of gift giving. And I think he was really implying...
And food, right.
And he was really more or less implying that the biggest gift that we could give would be ourselves. Mm-hmm. It could be ourselves, our time, our generosity, our solidarity with others. So very nice words.
The expression we used to have this program called Putting Christ Back into Christmas.
Yeah.
Right?
That's it. Used to have. We need that every day. With the very secular world that we live in today, people trying to take not only Christ out of Christmas, but I mean just Christianity out of cultures and everything. But all of the Pope's remarks dovetailed very beautifully this week with the message from, which I'm going to post on my blog Friday, because that'll be my last one before I leave for Bethlehem for Christmas. I'll be there 10 days. But the Custos, the Franciscan Custos of the Holy Land, Father Pizzaballa, posted his Christmas message. And basically, the title of it was Come to Bethlehem. And I thought, my word, I answered that call even before he issued his message. But he talks again about this economic crisis that has struck the world, and he says either being poor, the possibility of becoming poor is very real for people. And he said, but there is a greater poverty than material poverty, and that's poverty of the soul. And he basically invited people to Bethlehem to find hope. There is hope here, and the soul can be cured in Bethlehem. So I will come back and tell our listeners all about that experience. I'm really very excited. I will be staying in Bethlehem for 10 days. I do have friends there. I will be visiting Bethlehem University, run by the Christian Brothers. And a priest friend in the Vatican told me there's a Catholic maternity hospital. And I went online, learned a lot about it. It's called Holy Family Hospital in Bethlehem.
And it was started by the Order of Malta, right?
And I believe, yes. And it's there's a foundation in the United States, I've forgotten, honestly, now, whether it's New York or Washington, that supports it. But in any event, I did look up and learn something about it. And I went out and bought two little gifts the other day at a store near my home. Two silver etchings, if you will, of a mother and child, Mary, Madonna and child. And one is on a blue fabric background. The other is on a pink fabric background. And these are gifts for babies. And I'm going to go to this hospital on Christmas Day and find out who the first little boy was that was born in Bethlehem on Christmas Day. And then I have a gift for a little boy, and whoever the first little girl, you know, to be born, I have a gift for that little girl, too. So I think that should be very exciting. There's a lot of stories, and there's many untold stories, as we know, in the Middle East. I want to spend a lot of time with the Christians, who are an ever-diminishing number. I want to spend a lot of time with the Palestinian Christians. It's a lot of the ones we met on our pilgrimage last February had not left Bethlehem in 5 years. I mean, we were blown away by that. They weren't allowed to leave, not because they didn't want to leave. They couldn't go to Bethlehem. To Jerusalem. It's 5 miles down the road. So it ought to be a very beautiful, very, very beautiful experience, a unique Christmas for sure.
I'll be thinking of you, Joan.
I'll be praying for our listeners, for all my colleagues, family, and friends for sure.
Thank you. Thanks there, as always, to Joan Lewis for sharing with us her thoughts. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.